I thought I heard it reset, but I guess I didn't wait long enough. What I was saying is that ATSC-1, oh, let me ask you, you got the part about run length encoding, right? Yes, the 50 bytes, the 50 bits of black, and then an ending bit, 50 bytes, the 50 bits of white, and then an end bit, and so on. And we got that one, so that a very small number of bits in that example can give you 150 pixels. Over to you, Eric, KQLAW. Okay, let me go on from there. Run length encoding is not efficient when each pixel is a different value, because we can't do that kind of compression. Although MPEG-2, which is the format that we use in ATSC-1, is smart enough to know about the combination of run length encoding and discrete cosine transform. We also do filtering to reduce the amount of data that we need to transmit the information. And there's various different kinds of filtering, and that's all based upon the way the eyeball sees. Okay. Now, ATSC-3 has the ability to use not only MPEG-2, but MPEG-4, H.264, and even JPEG-2000. The receivers are capable of decoding the various different formats. Now, the thing that I was saying about MPEG-4, let me let it drop again. MPEG-4 is very much more efficient. There's a couple different forms of it. The low level that MPEG-4 that you use, for example, when you're watching YouTube, you're really watching something that's MPEG-4. It might be embedded Real Player or various different formats. It uses many, many, many less bits than MPEG-2 does to produce the same kind of result. So the newer compressors are way more efficient. They're actually a bit more complicated. They're still based on what MPEG-2 was. Don't forget, that's many years ago now. And what we used for 4K is actually H.265, which is a more efficient codec than H.264 is. It also is capable of producing greater bandwidth. And ATSC-3, as opposed to ATSC-1. ATSC-1 runs at 19.39 megabits, and ATSC runs at 36 megabits. So there's a major difference in terms of how much stuff you can stuff into that space. K2RIW, K2JOIN.
If I was transmitting a picture of a checkerboard where I don't have 50 bits of black, 50 bits of white, and 50 pixels of white, and 50 pixels of black, but I've got a certain number of pixels of black, a certain number of pixels of white, and that pattern is then repeated 20 times across the screen. Is there a compact way of sending that? In other words, it's not 50 consecutive pixels of the same, but it's 100 pixels in your previous example, but it's a repeated step-and-repeat pattern. Is there a way that the system in its compactness can handle that situation, Eric? K2LAW?
All right, don't forget I just gave you a very simplistic idea of what goes on. And to get a little more towards the answer to the question that you're asking, when you break down all these different forms of MPEG, whether it's MPEG-2, MPEG-4, JPEG-2000, something completely different, but we have something called a B frame, which is a bidirectional frame, and a P frame, which is predictive. So actually, when you're receiving the image, you're not getting it as the image of the first frame comes in, you see it displayed. There's actually some processing going on. What we do in terms of the whole image, okay, because MPEG is smart, it can determine there are preset limits in terms of where run length encoding is used and how it's used. Even though I said it's only 3 bytes of information, there's still more information in front of it saying, I'm going to be telling you that this is this sort of thing, and there's a whole different variety of this sort of things that it can send. Based upon what's coming in, there's something called an iframe, which is an information frame. That's usually the first frame that you get. That contains the entire picture, right? Now that includes the edge of your tail and everything else. Let me edit that. Based upon what's coming in, because the decision about am I going to use one length encoding for this little line of pixel, that's already been predetermined when the receiver gets the information as part of the stream. It will use a predictive plane just to get edge information as to where the edges are moving, which is important in terms of doing, making a temporal response that your eyeballs can see that's pleasing, that doesn't break up and stuff like that. So in essence, we'll be transmitting just edge information. Then we have this thing called a bidirectional plane, which will actually have a little bit of the previous plane and a little bit of the current plane, which is actually a little bit of the future plane. So there's that kind of processing going on. So when you have something that is a regular pattern, a little bit of one length encoding goes on and a little bit of bidirectional stuff goes on. And there's the smarts in the codec to figure all that out. So, get your IWK to reject.
Television and digital processing of radio signals, boy, we've come a long way. You ain't seen nothing yet. What? Weak signal, Joe Taylor. I mean, the way the ham radio operators are using super weak signals, minus 28 dB signal to noise ratio with proper digital signal processing, are getting, you know, 90% copy rate out of moon bounce and very weak meteor scatter and so on signals. Now, a slightly different subject, Eric. Getting back a couple of paragraphs with you. You went to your B coverage area with an antenna, raised it a small number of feet above the ground, and came to the conclusion you can get good ATS-C1 digital decoding video signals. However, when you did that experiment, I suspect that you were using a very modern converter, so to speak, or in other words, which...
I was using my digital signal analyzer, which actually will give me the actual EVM and SNR and the error rate, and that's without equalization, no less.
Okay, you had some very sophisticated equipment and you were getting a good picture. Of the television sets I could typically buy and own at that time.
So you used one of those too, and a cheap one also.
So you're telling me even a cheap television set purchased at that time in your B areas with that simple area antenna gave you a good picture. And therefore, when everyone claims that they have less range with the new system, the new digital over-the-air system, you think the range really is the same, even though less power is being transmitted over your KQRIW?
I'll give you a little interesting tidbit, which is one of the experiments done not only by me, but by a number of people. We picked somebody at a grade B area. Now, you know, if you pull a car over and put the antenna up 20 feet, not every spot works perfectly because, you know, there might be a water tower here or something like that, or there might be a co-channel station coming in from, you know, the other direction. What we've done is we took somebody in a grade B area where they got, and we've measured a good SNR right there and then. I then dropped the SNR in the transmitter by 2 or 3 dB, and their picture goes away. I raised my... You know, I lower the error rate that's actually coming out of the transmitter, and lo and behold, the picture comes back, and it's, you know, nice and solid. So there's a lot of variables in this.
When it comes to over-the-air digital television reception, Joe and I have been both advocating something, and I saw some experiment done by you at your location that confirmed what I'm about to say, that there's a... In the old days, you put a rotator on your television aerial, on your chimney of your house, in order to decide to watch either New York City or Hartford, Connecticut, 90 degrees away, here out here on Long Island. Nowadays, for digital television reception, just from New York City only, because every reasonable television aerial you and I can buy really doesn't have a nice, clean, Gaussian main lobe pattern. It's got a whole bunch of fingers in space, with a whole bunch of side lobes. So with a minor amount of re-aiming of the antenna, a number of multipath situations and co-channel interference situations will go away if you're willing to aim the antenna that particular night while watching. And so I'm telling people who want to watch over the air television, and Joe is telling them also, there's a lot to be said by using a rotator. Now, let me drop this. With your television receiving aerial on the tower at your broadcast site, I was at your facility once when you were watching over the air digital television from New York City, and I watched you re-aim that antenna in order to get better apparent signal, better bit error rate.
And you know why, right?
Tell me why.
And I'm sure Joe can attest to you. There are certain channels that have this sort of bowing in the signal when you look at it on a spectrum analyzer. Okay, and I can tell you exactly what stations the antennas have to be moved for. And it's unique to New York. It's not, say for example, if you lived in the Midwest, you wouldn't be speaking the same thing. Your experience would be totally different. Or down south, your experience would be totally different. In New York, we do something really stupid. People who did it don't care. Besides, their channels are changing, and where they're broadcasting from is changing. So, this is a temporary fix for the largest saturation of audience, which happens to be Brooklyn and Staten Island. And what they did was they put up an antenna that's supposed to be pointed that way. It's supposed to be something like a 45-degree beam, so to speak. But sorry, folks, when you actually measure it, it turns out to be like 180 degrees, or a little bit bigger than that. The fact that you're receiving this stuff damaged already, meaning the bit rate is way higher than it's supposed to be, that's what you're fighting, and that's why they're pointing at the antenna.
Yeah, Joe calls this a scalloping effect when he looks on his spectrum analyzer on, say, for instance, Channel 4, which has these fill-in antennas that are aimed for the close-in folks. And so the interferometry of the fill antenna plus the main top of the mast broadcast antenna, the interferometry between those two gives us that scalloping effect. The scalloping effect, I think you're saying, is one of the main reasons why aiming. So for a person who's watching over-the-air television for the last 5 years or the next 2 years, there's still a lot of merit to having an antenna rotator on his television aerial when he watches from Long Island, the current New York City station.
No argument.
Okay, we're in agreement on that one. So, you believe that, I still think because of multipath. In my particular case, I'm getting an echo off of that water tower that's a small distance away from, small distance in azimuth and a small distance in miles away from me. I'm reasonably sure I would need a antenna rotator in order to get reliable reception in the presence of that water tower.
Now, that's on your new TV set?
Roger, Dodger.
So it says it recovers from that too well, or it picks it up and then goes away, or something like that?
All of the above. Now, I'm getting times when certain channels drop out. Is it because of co-channel interference, or is it because of multipath? And on a rainy day, is the echo off that water tower better than on a dry day? I'm not sure. But certain number of my channels, when I think I'm not getting co-channel, certain number of my channels come and go, this half hour versus that half hour, Monday versus Tuesday. I've got a number of flaky channels, particularly 9-2, 9-3, occasionally 4, 4-1, 4-2, and so on. So I'm convinced that I'm vulnerable to multipath.
Channels you get solid.
ABC is solid all the time. 47 is solid all the time. 50 is almost always solid. 55 is quite solid. Let me think now. 13 to me is very solid. Many of the others are a little bit flaky at times. 21, of course, is always solid. Over to you, Eric.
You know, you're really experiencing the effects of... How do you get 11, by the way?
Except for last night, 11 is almost always there.
All right. So, 11-13 and 7, by the way, on 11-13 and 7. So they're VHF, they're high VHF you're picking up. When 11 goes away, it's usually when the band's open. The other channels that come and go, if they would turn the backfill antenna off, you wouldn't have that problem. And we know for a fact that that's true because we've set that up in a number of places where they always have trouble with it. You turn the backfill antenna off and boom, it's nice and solid.
Which of my branded channels have the backfill antenna in operation right now, Eric? Wait for the beep and go ahead.
Let's see, 28, 33, who else is there, 31, Mac 9's on that also, they're 38, that's not all fresh in my mind. Your channel 50 is coming from New Jersey, 55 is coming from behind you, 21 of course is coming from in front of you, and there's a couple more. 50, I wonder, how well do you get 50? That's interesting, because that's a long throw.
Dick, comment on this?
Yeah, I get 50 very well. Before I turn it over to Joe, Eric, you were giving me the real channel numbers. Give me the branded channel numbers when you tell me the ones that have backfill. 4, I know, has backfill. 4, branded. Give me the branded numbers that have backfill. Over to you, Eric.
249... 31, and there's another one or two which I forget.
Is there a local? Yes, there is. Okay, go ahead, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
All right, I see the scatter pattern on 3 RF frequencies, RF-28, RF-33, and RF-38. RF-28 is 4... digital 4, that's NBC. RF-33 is digital CBS channel 2. RF-38 is digital 9, WOR. I mean, I think they share with channel 5 on their frequency, RF-44, they're one of the channels. So when you tune to one of the 9 sub-channels, you're actually tuning to RF-44. They have a clean panel in the air, and they don't have this type of problem. I'll just make one other comment. I think I said this before to you. I tried an experiment one time by purposely putting an attenuator in front of my converter to purposely lower the signal of what I had. And even with rotating the antenna back and forth a couple of degrees, the first channels to go were the channels with the scalloped patterns. They had at least about a 10 dB difference between those and their channels from New York that did not have a scalloped pattern and were clean. So I was able to receive the other channels that had clean carriers much lower in signal strength than these ones with scallop patterns. So it does make a difference out here, Dick. And your system might just be not picking them up too terribly well. I don't understand why. But those are going to be the first channels to go on. If you have any code channel appearance, and also they're going to be the first ones to get whacked out.
So that scalloping gives you about another anywhere between 6 and 10 dB of less signal noise and a much higher EVM number.
If I had enough gain, if I had enough preamplifier gain at the antenna, Eric, with a scallop pattern, is there any chance that I could get some limiting factor where the scalloping becomes flatter, or would the, I suspect the HBSD is not going to tolerate that, so... An overloaded gain front end is not going to help. But he dropped the signal strength with a check.
Definitely make it work, especially as you add noise to it.
But if I've got low noise, high gain, you're saying that's not what eliminates the scattering, the scalloping.
Oh, but it actually might improve the SNR enough for you to get a solid picture all the time.
So you believe as you were doing that attenuating, Joe, it was really a signal-to-noise ratio change that added to the scalloping is what made those particular channels drop out. To be 2RYY, K2RYW.
It's very possible, but looking at the pilot carrier level compared to the other channels, they were similar. They're all very similar in signal level. They don't vary a drastic amount from one channel to another. Like channel RF-25, is a little less in signal strength than RF-24. 24's got a pretty good signal. RF-33 RF-30 is a good signal, RF-36 is a good signal, RF-44 is a good signal. Nice clean pattern, nice strong signal. The other carriers are not that low, much lower in relative signal strength. Looking at pilot carrier, that's 309.4 kilohertz above the bottom end of the band, okay, right, relatively. But the ones with the scalar pattern, the pattern where some have two, some have three dips. The dips are like 15 to almost 20 dB between the top of the carrier that you see. It's happening noise. Even looking at the, you know, with the bandwidth set properly on a spectrum analyzer, there's still a 15 to 20 dB dip. So
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Let me point something out here.
So the backfill is giving 15 to 20 dB of scalloping? Wow. Go ahead, Eric.
Let's just be clear about whether the pilot's there or not, it doesn't make the receiver receive or not. Okay. The pilot is digitally generated, by the way. And that sits at a specific point right past the lower edge of the band of the signal. Don't forget, this whole signal, if you were to look at it on a regular scope, looks like an amplitude modulated signal. The fact that it looks like a flat line on a spectrum analyzer, that only comes after you pass it through what's called a Nyquist filter. So, if you were to figure out the group delay of what's going on in that scalloping thing, that winds up having the symbols knocking into each other almost in terms of the delay that occurs. What it is the mixing of the signals or the reflection that's adding and subtracting in time of each one of those symbols. So you get something that drops down. Remember, the receiver isn't going to lock up on anything that's less than, say, let's call it making an IC number, let's say 20 dB signal or noise. Whereas where the pilot is, you might actually have an SNR of 28 or almost 30. When you get down to the point in frequency where they're really banging into each other, you might have an SNR of, say, 17 or 16. And the receiver, the INQ decoder, is going, what's this? C2RWK2J.
Great stuff. Is there absolutely no pilot signal on the COFDM? And on the COFDM. Yeah, there's 1,000 individual carriers, but when we start looking with a spectrum analyzer, which
looks the same,
with a narrow band filter, will I see that pilot signal on ATSC 3 when it gets transmitted? Will Joe be able to find that 309.4 kilohertz from the low?
No.
So there will be no pilot tone on the new ATSC 3.
Right, and the pilot on ATSC 1 is a training signal.
Yeah, but still, it has a very, with a narrow enough filter, it's got a very exact frequency. It's a timing signal. It's a reference timing signal in order to start the demodulation process. And Joe's experiment leads him to believe that with the converters that he owns, it's a very important signal. Anything that corrupts that signal makes the converter go bonkers real fast. Over to you, Alan Eric.
Depending upon where things are, so to speak, you can actually have a very low pilot signal and still have a relatively flat response on your spectrum analyzer and still be able to lock up to it. Again, it's where in the threshold, because essentially what you're doing is you're taking the RF carrier and you're sticking it into two balanced modulators or four quadrant multipliers, however you want to call it. One being fed 90 degrees out of phase with the other, and that has to work across the 6 megahertz. So there's a lot of room for variation as long as it stays within a certain threshold. As soon as that timing of this stuff, which, don't forget, the spectrum analyzer is showing you something in the frequency domain, not in the time domain. The timing of this stuff that you were looking at it in the time domain, you would actually see these bits merge into one another. And when that happens, you don't get nothing.
On my digital demodulator, the local thing in my television set, I suspect that the reference oscillator that's local to really do his demodulating, I suspect it has to be fairly accurate to a small number of nanoseconds.
Within 50.
So within 50 nanoseconds is required for everything to come out right. Now anything that creates 50 nanoseconds of a temporal error is going to goof up my converter. Plus or minus 50, is that the place where there's a 50% probability of dropout, Eric?
Yeah, more modern sets are a little bigger than that. I think the number's something like 72 or something in that neighborhood. Actually, some decoders are pretty good. When you start getting ridiculous numbers, they still produce an output. You know, there's more to it because you've got something called Prelate, and then after that you got Reed Solomon to fix some of the problems. But you know, they have their limits too. When you exceed that, you get nothing.
With ATSC 3 COFDM, are there also some critical timing factors required for proper demodulation?
Yeah, well, with any digital stuff, especially if you're doing something that's asynchronous, you need something to say to the oscillator, hey, start right here. So it doesn't matter whether you're doing COFDM or ATSC or ATSK or QPSK, same deal.
But because COFDM has the equivalent of 1,000 individual carriers, if some of those carriers get corrupted, but you still got 995 others,
still got a picture.
That's what I was about to say. So in other words, a well-designed converter has now got a large number of ways that it can recover that clock signal. Is that true?
That's true. That's why in the 90s, Sinclair wanted to go that way in the first place. Actually, what we've come up with now in ATSC far exceeds this COFDM that's used in DVB-T, which is used all over Europe.
So for the last 8 years or so, Europe has a superior system to us. You're saying we've taken their system and beefed it up even more, and ours is going to be even better than Europe? Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yes, I am. That's why they're considering using it there, too. Even though they still use a different line standard, even though it really doesn't matter in the digital world. But the test that we've done in this country and what Korea is doing has been very, very good looking. The one thing I will say about you're calling the European system superior, whereas that their grade Bs are well within our grade As, and 8BSB, when you're close to a transmitter, even when you get multipasses, it's pretty darn good. So you'd be surprised the number of people in and around the city that are using rabbit ears and are quite happy with it.
Yeah, they've got their fill antenna specifically dedicated to them, and they're happy. Out here, we're not. In your current European system, if I took it and I now want it updated to what the American system is going to become, what changes are required? What's the real difference between current European and what will be our new system? Over to you, Eric.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay, yeah. You didn't wait for the beep. I heard a sound. I didn't understand it. Give it to me again, Eric.
It's all software. The concept of getting to the point where you can demodulate something, getting it from an IF to a digital form, is the same amongst all the various different systems. You know, the difference is that angular resolution in terms of what you're putting together, but the basic concept of getting there is the same.
The front end of a radio frequency identification interrogator, the receiver, and the receiver of the front end of our digital television set, I think have a strong similarity. Your RF signal is deep down to an IF signal. The IF signal goes through a four-quadrant demodulator. You have a real bipolar in phase and a bipolar quadrature signal. Those two bit streams, I presume, then go to a pair of analog to digital converters. You got an I, A to D, and you got a Q, A to D. And after that, the digital processing was what does all the magic. So I think you're saying that the new digital processing beyond that point, our new one is a little bit better than the one Europe is currently using, OUR, KQRIW.
You're still on analog, man. No, actually what we'll do is we'll take the IF and do a direct A to D on it. And then, by using math, we will actually do the demodulation and break it out into INQ. And the balance modulators are four quadrant multipliers, however you want to do it. It's actually in software, or in the case, it might be an FPGA. You know, which is set up hardware-wise to do exactly the same thing. But it does it in the digital domain. It does it it does it actually with an FFT, believe it or not.
Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid that some of the listeners of the TechNet are going to say, hey, you guys are discussing television continuously now, not real ham radio. Let me break off for a minute and give you guys a real ham radio discussion. Based on the letter that I sent to ARRL on the doctor is in that got misinterpreted. And Eric, this particular question, I'd like you not to answer it because you got some a priori knowledge. Let me drop it. Here's a real ham radio situation. I've got a modern day 100 watt transceiver, 80 through 10 meter transceiver. It's feeding 100 feet cable, which is feeding a good antenna. The cable is a 50 ohm coax. The frequencies where I'm using it, the antenna is a perfect 50 ohm load. And by the way, between the transmitter and that transmitter and transmission line in the shack, I've got a bird watt meter. So transmitter, if you're looking at the flow now, transmitter, bird watt meter, 100 feet of 50 ohm cable, nearly ideal 50 ohm antenna. Everything looks great, with one exception. The transmitter just happens to have an output impedance of not 50 ohms, but 100 ohm output impedance transmitter. Something's wrong with my particular transmitter. It's got 100 ohm impedance. What is the standing wave ratio of that situation? Anybody out there got a guess? Please give me a call letter and a guess right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
A VDH with a guess?
That's a VDH. Give me the full call. Name and something to VDH. What is the biz one in that situation? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say that the VizWire is 1-to-1 because it's usually determined by the load impedance, not the source impedance. Go ahead.
Very few people say that. Okay, do we have any other answers? A 100 ohm transmitter feeding a 50 ohm system. What's the VizWire? Anybody got any other answer?
Anyway.
Okay. I didn't understand that last comment. Who was that? Please repeat.
Standing wave, that's one.
Okay, I heard you say standing wave, blank. Fill in that sentence.
2-to-1.
Okay, who am I talking to?
Doesn't matter.
Okay, you think it's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The bird watt meter will read 100 watts forward, because the transmitter is producing 100 watts. What reverse power will the bird watt meter read? The bird watt meter is going to predict, it's going to predict what standing wave ratio.
EXM?
Something EXM. Give me the full call and your name, and then tell me your answer, EXM.
To our WWDQ Golf X-Ray, Mike Rich. The reverse reading will be 0.
Okay. So therefore, the bird watt meter is telling you what standing wave ratio, Rich.
That would be 1-to-1, I concur.
Okay, you guys are a little bit smarter than the average. The vast majority of hams, including most of the staff, from what I can tell, of AR Oil headquarters, believe that that situation has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if I ask them what the bird watt meter is going to read, they tell me it's going to read a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now, how this came about is because if you take a look at the latest issue of QST, the June issue, the very first question and answer in the doctor is in section, a man is using a UHF connector, a PL258. That's the female-to-female adapter in the PL series. And it has an internal impedance, depending on who you talk to, it's either 27 ohms or 35 ohms, but it's often 50 ohms. And it's a fairly long device. By the time you put a PL259 at the input end and a PL259 at the output end, he's using this as a junction device to join two pieces of cable. He's using a PL258, the female-to-female adapter, to join two pieces of cable. So it has close to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio built into the connector itself, but the connector is only a total of 1.78 inches long. Let me drop it. And the reason I wrote a letter to them is to say that where you put that adapter makes a huge difference. You would say that that adapter, you can go through a calculation of how many degrees long it is at your particular operating frequency. And in the article, one of the frequencies used was 432. At 432, it has a pretty big impact. It creates a standing wave ratio with a 50 ohm output load on that thing. The input of that thing, the PL258 assembly, will give you something like a 2.73, I think it is, standing wave ratio. A 2.73 standing wave ratio on 100 feet of cable is going to create some excess loss in the cable because signal is bouncing back and forth. However, the answer that was given in the article is based on the assumption that that splicing device is put directly at the antenna after 100 feet of cable. Nobody would do splicing at the antenna, if you know what I mean. You're going to splice somewhere along the line. As you move that splicing device closer and closer to the shack, the extra insertion loss in the cable goes to zero. That was my point. The point did not get received at all. Now, the people at the headquarters, they're positive that a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, no matter where it is in the cable, is going to give you this extra loss. As you move this device all the way down to the shack, when it drops, you might have some bouncing signal between the transmitter and that device, but that bouncing signal is going through, you know, 1 foot of cable, and the extra loss is going to be very, very small. So that point I was trying to make, unfortunately, I put a couple of other comments in the letter, and it all got very confused. And so I didn't get my point across. So when you put a lump of standing wave ratio in a transmission line, where it is makes a big difference when it comes to the excess loss. And in the case of a 100-ohm transmitter connected to a 50-ohm system, you don't necessarily couple all of the potential power from that transmitter into the line. But whatever power enters the line, it experiences exactly a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio because the power goes down the line once, hits the 50-ohm antenna, and all it gets radiated. There's no reflected energy on the line itself. And if there's no reflected energy, there is no standing wave ratio. People think that if there's a mismatch anywhere in a system, you've got standing wave ratio everywhere in the system. Good common sense, dead wrong. Anybody have any comments on this? Give me a call with us right now. K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW.
Go ahead, Eric.
It's interesting listening to the way you describe this, but it reminds me of what we do when we're doing pool feeds, and especially audio. How do you feed, 100 inputs all at the same time? You can either use DAs. The input impedance of all these things is going to be 600 ohms. And you're going to wind up putting them all in parallel with a little isolation test. Or you could just take without any distortion, without anything coming back at you. It's not exactly the same as RF is what we're talking about here. Whereas that in the audio world, you can feed something with a really low impedance into something that's a higher impedance and not have to deal with anything. It's RIWK to return.
I disagree with you a little bit, Eric. If I had a whole bunch of audio sources that I want to be combined without them interfering with each other, if I put each one of them through a series resistor, that in turn goes into the negative lead of an operational amplifier. An operational amplifier used correctly is measuring the current from each one of those resistors.
We're talking balanced input, but yeah, I think that's generally what we do is we put a small resistor between everything that's isolation.
Not only isolation, the small resistor is what's telling you the amount of gain you're going to get out of an operational amplifier.
Yeah, well, you're feeding it with a giant amplifier, you're not feeding a small signal.
The combiner that I'm trying to describe, using an operational amplifier, the input of the operational amplifier is an almost zero-ohm dead short circuit, but it senses current. And therefore, if I've got 50 sources of audio going through 50 individual resistors that all go to the negative lead of the op-amp, which is a short circuit, all of those signals are thoroughly isolated from each other because they're all feeding a resistor that feeds a short circuit back into another source, if you know what I mean. It doesn't matter. There's no coupling of those signals. The op-amp gives you a beautiful way of getting isolation. If I had zero feeding sources and I put them all in parallel with each other, they're going to be feeding signals to each other, Eric, as I see it. KE2EJ, KQIW.
KQIW, KE2EJ. Well, we're talking about, you know, existing gear out there. It's all there for the same purpose. They all have balanced input. You're doing this in a balanced form. And, of course, most of them have transformer isolation in the front, so when you're in a pickle, you got to feed 50 to 75 audio sources. That's what they do, and it works just fine. Designing something here, we're using stuff that already exists, but you might be feeding, you know, 50 different line mixers, or, in my world, everything has a standard. We use XLRs for making audio connections, and there are ways to have, they make things called DAs, or distribution amplifiers, where each output will match an input and is isolated from one another. When those things break, we do something like take a stereo amplifier and wire it up so that we're creating at 8 ohms a balanced output that you're feeding all these XLRs with, literally in parallel, and you're able to get what you need without any severe detriment to, you know, doing this distribution. You might be doing this just for voice, you know, like a pool feed or you could be doing music, but because of the standard in which all the audio gear that we use has isolation in the front end, you don't worry about that stuff.
If the output of my amplifiers, of my sources of audio, were a constant current generator, I could put all of those in parallel and there wouldn't be any cross coupling. but if each one of them is a 0.0 impedance constant voltage generator, and you put them in parallel, and if they've got any damping factor, any feedback ratio, any feedback factor in those amplifiers, then I think the audio coming out of amplifier number one being expressed directly across the output circuit of amplifier number two, I think you could get some cross-coupling and some distortion from that, Eric. Go ahead, K2LAW.
Nope. Because what we do is we... And hey, this gets done all the time. You take a big amplifier, like a Macintosh, right? And you hook up to it a transformer that has basically isolation. There's a lot of stuff out there. You don't want the ground, particularly a ground loop for you. So you take that output, you feed it into an 8-ohm transformer, and use that 8-ohm transformer to go to all these either 10K or a 600-ohm input in parallel, and away you go.
Now getting back to my original question, 100-ohm transmitter feeding a 50-ohm system, third watt meter, 50-ohm cable, 50-ohm antenna. What's the standing wave ratio of that system? Well, if I'm talking about the standing wave ratio on the transmission line, it's 1:1. If I'm talking about the standing wave ratio of the total system, transmitter and everything else included, yes, you could say it is 2:1. It's a 100-ohm transmitter feeding a 50-ohm load. So some of the potential power of the transmitter never got out of the transmitter, so to speak. If it's a 100-watt transmitter when it's a 100-ohm load, and you're putting a 50-ohm load on it, you're going to get less than 100 watts out of that transmitter under normal circumstances. There's a couple of catches here, though. The transmitters that we all use, back in the old days, they were tetro tubes. Nowadays, they're output transistors. The transistor is very close to a constant current generator. A tetro tube is definitely a constant current generator. What we do when we're lining up the transmitter is we adjust the drive of the transmitter so that it's capable of producing 100 watts of output. Let me go up. And then if back in the days when you really had a tuning and loading control, they had a real Pi network, you adjust the tuning and loading controls to maximize the output. When you did that, you created a impedance match between the antenna port, the 50-ohm port, and the output of the transmitter, and maybe the answer was something like 4,000 ohms from the output of the tube itself. And under those conditions, you maximize the power, and therefore you think you had an impedance match. However, if you now took the drive of that tube transmitter with the Pi network output and lowered the amount of drive so that under normal circumstances, instead of producing 100 watts, it's producing 10 watts. And now if you readjusted the Pi network, the 10 watts would go up to maybe 20 watts. To which you're about to say, hey, what's the real output of these here? What's going on with the constant current generator characteristic of a tetro type tube is that when you set it for full drive and you adjust your Pi network, you think you're impedance matching. Not really. Let me drop it. Final tube amplifier, maybe it was a 6146, maybe the 800 volts being applied to that plate circuit. When under 400 watt power output, there was 6146, by the way, in parallel in the transmitter, full drive power. When you adjust the impedance to get maximum power output, what's happening is that on the negative swing on the voltage coming out of that plate, the voltage on the plate probably goes down to about 100 volts on the negative end. On the positive end of the sine wave, it probably goes up to 1600 volts. You've got an 800 volt power supply, it goes to 1600 volts, 1600 volts on the positive peak, and close to 0 volts on the negative peak. If you adjusted the impedance of the Pi network to be even higher, you'd be trying to force the tube to go below 0 volts on the plate. It's not going to go there. And so, because of the limitation of the tube can't go below 0, and you've only got an 800 volt supply, the system is clamped at some particular maximum sine wave voltage it can produce. So even though the tube itself
be an output impedance of 4,000 or 8,000 ohms. Because of the voltage clamping characteristic, there is a particular adjustment of impedance of that pi network that gives you maximum power output. Let me drop. Therefore, when you're adjusting your transmitter, you're adjusting it, you're doing an impedance match for performance, not for a matched load and a matched source impedance situation. You're performance matching, not impedance matching. You'd be amazed how many people don't realize that. What really happens in the case of standing wave ratio, when some of the power is reflected back to that transmitter, where the true impedance of the transmitter is a very high number, it's a constant current generator. The power reflected back to the transmitter does not get absorbed by the transmitter. The vast majority of it, because, by the way, a constant current generator, let me backtrack on this one. When you're studying circuits at the college level, and you've got a number of sources and a whole bunch of network of resistors, and you're trying to figure out this network of resistors and those sources, what's the final output voltage of that network going to be? Let me drop. When it comes to studying what impedance you have at each node of that network, you make each of the constant current generators an open circuit, you make each of the constant voltage generators a short circuit, and then you go and calculate the impedance. Well, let's backtrack on that one. The constant current generator, an open circuit, your tetro tube is so close to a constant current generator, it's nearly an open circuit. Now, the power that's reflected back to your transmitter because of the standing wave ratio of your antenna can't get absorbed by the transmitter, which is an open circuit. It gets re-reflected forward. Depending on the length of that transmission line and the particular frequency you're operating at, that signal gets re-reflected forward in phase, out of phase, or in quadrature with the signal that the transmitter is producing right now. When you put an antenna tuner in that situation, it corrects all this for you, but what is the antenna tuner doing? It's setting up that magic impedance at the output port of the antenna tuner so that the power reflected from your antenna hits the output port of the antenna tuner, gets re-reflected forward in phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter right now. You change the length of the transmission line when you think you're going to upset that apple cart, as long as you're willing to readjust the tuning and loading control of your antenna tuner, you'll come back to the exact same situation again, where the power reflected back to the antenna tuner gets re-reflected forward. A well-designed antenna tuner, let me drop. A well-designed antenna tuner is well-shielded, so it doesn't radiate any signal. It's made out of a very low-loss component. It doesn't absorb any energy and turn it into heat. It's an impedance-matching device, yes, but it's doing something more magic than that. It's not only creating a perfect match between the transmitter and your crazy antenna system, it is doing, when you're adjusting for best performance of your antenna tuner, you are forcing this magic situation where any reflected power gets re-reflected forward, and as long as your transmission line is low enough and long, like with the open wire line, in theory, almost all of that reflected power finally does get radiated. It's going to bounce back and forth some number of times. That's where some extra loss of the line might occur, but if the line loss is low enough to begin with, that becomes negligible. Now, when it comes to an automatic antenna tuner, what is it doing? Let me drop. The automatic antenna tuner has a directional coupler inside that's looking at the signal being reflected back from the antenna. It measures the amplitude and the phase angle of that signal that's being reflected back to the antenna tuner. That information, with the built-in brain and the computer network that's in there, tells it how to set your tuning and loading control of your antenna tuner so you get that magic situation where all the reflected power gets re-reflected forward. There's a huge number of people, particularly on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, who believe that antenna tuners are a waste of time because they just take all the reflected power and throw it away. Well, how could it possibly do that? Throw it away. What does that mean? Radiate the space? It's a well-shielded structure. Turn it into heat? A well-designed antenna tuner runs ice cold. Send it back to the transmitter? Your bird watt meter on the input end of that antenna tuner shows no reflected power. By the laws of conservation of energy, there's nothing left. It's got to be re-reflecting it forward toward the antenna. You'd be amazed how many people don't accept that. If we have any further questions or comments, give me a call, let us right now. K2RW in the tech end.
Question, K2CJE.
DDH with a comment.
Okay, Ed first and then DDH next. We'll eventually find out DDH's name. Go ahead, Ed.
Dick, can we go back to before the Pi network when we just had a coil and a capacitor as a tank and we built our own antenna tuners and we looked at the plate current and we saw, let's say, 80 milliamps. We then made some adjustments to the antenna tuner components and we brought it up to 100 milliamps and we thought we were putting out more power. What was happening? Over.
Okay. Every transmitter has a rated current that's supposed to be drawn by the final tube when you're at maximum power output key down. Your particular transmitter is rated for 200 milliamps of plate current. And you adjust the tuning and loading control so that you're simultaneously in resonance. In other words, you've adjusted the tuning control so you're at the dip. And the dip is 200 milliamps, and you've got the loading control set right. If you set the loading control too heavy, you'll draw more than 200 milliamps. If you draw make the loading control too light, you'll draw less than 200 milliamps. And you might arc over the transmitter too, by the way. Very light loading at full power output of a transmitter could be a dangerous condition where the plate voltage goes to swinging real great numbers. So the right amount of current at resonance, by the way, you could get higher plate current from two conditions, loading too heavy or out of resonance. Only in resonance is the place where you should be. You got to make sure that your tuning and loading controls of your Pi network do not run out of range. If they run out of range, you think you've got a dip, and it's not a dip. Let me drop it. So if the manufacturer tells you to set your transmitter at full power output with the right amount of drive level, so to speak, setting, at 200 milliamps of plate current in resonance, you're using it in the rated manner. You could now set it at a heavier loading and maybe increase the drive and make it draw 300 milliamps. You might get more power output. You may, if you take the cover off the transmitter, when you're operating that way, key down, you may find out that the plate circuit is glowing red and you're drastically lowering the life of that particular tube. Maybe that's part of the answer you're looking for. I think you might have a follow-on question on that one, Ed. K2GJE, K2RIW with the TechNet.
Ago, we didn't have a loading. All we had was the capacitor across the tank that we tuned for a dip. We tuned for a dip, and we got a certain amount of current. Then we didn't have any SWR meters. We made some adjustments, possibly even on the link to the tank, and on the homemade antenna tuner, and we came up with more current. And I'm not going to exceed, of course, let's say, the rating of the tube, but we were able to get supposedly more power out. Over.
When you're adjusting the link on a transmitter, you are adjusting the loading coefficient. You are changing the loading. When you're using an antenna tuner, which really in many cases is a Pi network, you now have the ability to change the loading. By changing the loading, I mean, if under normal conditions the transmitter output connector is supposed to see a 50 ohm resistor and is supposed to draw 200 milliamps of plate current and be in resonance, okay? By readjusting the link, you can make that loading heavier. By readjusting the antenna tuner, you can make the load heavier. By load heavier, I mean the transmitter now thinks it's seeing a 25 ohm load instead of a 50 ohm load. It'll draw more current, and you could reestablish resonance. And with that resonance at the higher current, you are exceeding the rating of the tube. The tube is going to run hotter, the plate might glow red, and therefore you might have decreased length of the tube. So whether you're adjusting the link or